Hello. Welcome to Horror Night. I'm David Crawford. I play Dr. Foster in Dawn of the Dead. Dr. Foster tries to warn the world about zombies, but they don't listen.
In 1968, George Romero brought us Night of the Living Dead. It became the classic horror film of its time. Now, George Romero brings us the most intensely shocking motion picture experience for all times. Dawn of the Dead. Dawn of the Dead contains scenes of violence that may be considered shocking. No one under 17 will be admitted.
Foster wipes his sweat with a dirty handkerchief. He pulls his tie away from his tight collar and pops the shirt button open. He is desperate now, shivering with anger and frustration. TV Man 2.
There is a martial law state in effect in Philadelphia, as in all other major cities in the country.
Oh,
must understand the dire phenomenon. Should we be unable to check the spread because of the emotional attitudes of the citizenry toward these issues of morality?
The man's frail shoulders seemed to crumble inward. He stood now clutching the back of his chair with one hand and raising the other in a gesture of defiance.
It is the order of the OEP, by command of the federal government, the President of the United States. Citizens may no longer occupy private residences, no matter how safely protected or well stocked.
A murmur in the studio begins to build to an emotional crescendo.
One woman gave a blood-curdling scream and fell to the floor in a heap. Another man cried out over and over again, "Air, air, I can't breathe."
Foster tries to talk over the noise,
but his voice cracked and he could barely be heard.
TV Man 2.
Citizens will be moved into central areas of the city.
Technicians abandon their posts. A few others jump in to take their places, but pandemonium reigns. A cameraman whips off his headset and breaks for the door. His camera spins on its liquid head, and on the monitors, we see a whirling blur as Foster continues to speak. Fran moves quickly for the spinning camera.
She tried to remember what Givens had told her to do in case of an emergency, but her mind was a blank.
She aims it back at the sweating Foster, and she stares through the viewfinder, not believing what she is seeing.
Foster was on the table, his shirt hanging out of his pants, his eyes like those of a wild man. His voice screeched out. He seemed like a prophet of old, foretelling of doom to an unbelieving population of barbarians.
TV Man 2.
The bodies of the dead will be delivered over to specially equipped squads of the National Guard for organized disposition.
Suddenly, a man darts out of the bustling crowd and comes up quickly behind Fran.
She jumped as the figure flashed into her view. Franny, the man whom she recognized as Steve, cried.
Steve.
Meet me on the roof at 9 o'clock. Getting out.
Fran, letting the camera slip slightly.
I don't believe
it. We're
going
to get out in the chopper.
Steven, we can't. We've got...
Another technician steps over to take the camera from Fran. Steven talks more quietly in the other man's presence. Steve.
It's 9 p.m. all right.
Fran.
Steven, we can't. We've got...
Steve.
We've got to nothing, Fran.
She looked into the soft brown eyes of the man she now loved. His dark hair was a mess, his clothes in disarray. His slight body, barely taller than hers, shook with a combination of nerves, fatigue, and astonishment at what he was about to do.
We've got to survive. Somebody's got to survive. Now, you be upstairs at 9 o'clock and don't make me come looking for you.
Steven is gone in a flash. Fran nervously looks back at the cameraman. The argument still rages between Foster and Berman. The cameraman, without taking his eye from the viewfinder, speaks to Francine quietly and slowly. Cameraman.
Go ahead. We'll be off the air by midnight anyway. The emergency networks are taking over. Our responsibility is finished.
Trance-like once again, Fran walked to the corner of the room where she had left her pocketbook and coat. All she had to do now was wait the 40 minutes until 9 o'clock. And what then? What next? The thought made her shudder.
The prior material was excerpted from the 1977 working draft of the motion picture Dawn of the Dead by George A. Romero, sound clips from the film itself, and including audio of Jonathan Davis reading from the novelization by Romero and Susanna Sparrow. In contrast to the last episode, this is a rather long minute. In the extended con cut, Foster's dialogue for this portion of the script begins at 4:36, and the musical cue that transitions the setting out of the WGON studio lasts until 6:08. Just ahead of this moment, Dr. Foster used the word phenomenon for the first of two times, with the second barely audible as a sentence was spoken while Steven was navigating past the guard. An aside, the script refers to Flyboy as Steve with a V, while in the film he's the more proper Steven with a PH. Not Captain Steve Rogers, but Dr. Stephen Strange. Speaking of doctors, Foster also utters the words without emotion twice for emphasis with regard to his pronouncements about how the undead must be dealt with. The sentiment will be more forcefully echoed by Richard France's unnamed scientist later in the picture, although his propositions are far more questionable and extreme than Foster's. For comparison, Foster makes his pointed announcement about the martial law state, which prompts Edla Terry's character to toss his note cards in the air, and Foster flinches at this. When Foster references the order from the OEP, he's presumably talking about the Office of Emergency Preparedness. This would give credence to anyone who wants to claim that Dawn is a direct sequel to 1968's Night of the Living Dead, because the OEP had already been shut down in 1973, half a decade before Dawn was released. It was replaced by FEMA in 1979. We have the moment where the cameraman quits and shoves the camera away from Foster and Berman, prompting Fran to seize and reposition it. I still need to identify that actor. Charlie Peters' character gives Foster bunny ears before being not so nicely pushed away by Berman. We get another pan across the floor of WGON staffers that I'll have to address later. The final credits roll out, produced by Richard P. Rubenstein and written and directed by George A. Romero. Steven pushes his way through the crowd to get to Fran, attracting the attention of the character played by Jim Edmondson, credited on IMDb as Jim/WGON-TV cameraman. Like Fran, Jim is one of the only people still doing their job and has some perspective on the situation unfolding.
Welcome to the commentary for Dawn of the Dead.
This is David Emge, Flyboy.
This is Scott Reiniger.
This is Galen Russ, Flygirl. And
Ken Forey.
Now you're having a very intense moment, the two of you.
That's right.
Oh, yes. Establishing the relationship.
You know, Galen, are you aware that the first time you see me in this film, you call me David?
Did I?
Yeah. He's told me that many times.
Yeah, it's true. In fact, I've watched this not all that long ago, just to confirm that for myself. But you had, after the opportunity for you to dub it, to change it, you were in Paris or something, so they just released it as it was. But so, the first time you see me, you say, David, what's going on? Or something like
and
that.
And nobody else, people caught
yeah,
it?
I tell people about that today, and they go, she did? You know, it's...
That's one thing for you fans to look out for. Someone email us and let us know. Did you hear her say David?
I don't remember saying David. But you answered, right?
Yeah, what was I going to do?
Name's David.
It was hard to call you Flyboy.
So, Galen, so what...
This was much later in the filming, wasn't it?
I don't remember, because I wasn't in this, so...
Yeah, he wasn't in the... I wasn't in the film.
The Argento cut runs the longest, about 6 minutes and 36 seconds. He lingers a bit longer on shots, and the Goblin score cuts out before Steven reaches Fran. It jarringly returns when Jim takes the headset from Fran, then fades out again as the scene ends. The theatrical cut is the tightest of the three, ending around 5:45. Where the con cut layer the Goblin and DeWolf Library scores for padding, the theatrical mostly sticks with La Alba de Morti Viventi, with the best sync of the three. Romero also offers the most dynamic scene transition, moving Dr. Foster's line about specially equipped squads of the National Guard to the end of the scene so that it can appear that he's referring to the SWAT team rappelling down the tenement wall of the next sequence. Going back to the first minute, Dr. Foster is first seen on a monitor bank in the room where Fran was sleeping, and his dialogue with Berman carries the first half dozen minutes, almost serving as a second soundtrack alongside Goblin. The pair get the second lines of dialogue, talking over each other, and serve to explain the premise of the movie to the audience. The pair have an interesting dynamic. While Foster isn't the sweaty, nervous mess described in the script and novelization, there is a twitchiness about him. He's very condescending, impatient that people aren't doing what he's plainly and at great length explaining what needs to be done. Berman, meanwhile, is very self-righteous and shouty, giving him a sense of moral authority. Even though it's Berman raising his voice and demonstrating more physical aggression, the audience is more likely to side with him over the snippy, imperious Foster. That may be some projection on my part. I grew up in what I used to jokingly call the ghetto, because like Eric Cartman, I'm overly fond of singing Elvis Presley's 1969 hit. However, with clearer eyes, I now recognize that it was a majority white neighborhood that was transitioning into a barrio. Since I lived in the minority-heavy apartments that lined the main road rather than in one of the houses that filled out the blocks, I just perceived the world as browner. The English-speaking black and white kids in the apartments were more likely to hang together, while the majority Spanish-speaking Latinos kept their own. The late-coming Vietnamese immigrants were wild cards, more likely to roll with us, when not with their own. So most of my childhood friends were black, and the same went for my grandmother's, from when she still worked, whom we'd occasionally visit after she retired. We also tended to watch a lot of black-oriented animated television like The Jeffersons, Good Times, What's Happening, or for my part, Soul Train. The point is, when I first started watching Dawn of the Dead, I was predisposed toward favoring Berman. As I got older and paid more attention to the content of the argument, I logically recognized that it was Dr. Foster who was in the right. It didn't go much deeper than that, though, because I was watching society collapse, not keeping score. A lot of people were bringing up this sequence earlier this year in regard to the United States' disastrous response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Having grown up in the 1970s, I saw a lot of societal shift in the way that decade gave way to the 1980s. In general, there was a sense of feel-good, hippie, liberal naivete early in the 70s that was overcome by a ruthless argument for pragmatism in the 80s. The 70s felt looser and the 80s more uptight, but one major 70s departure was the harsh discourse of opinion sections in news programs. Back then, if you did an opinion piece from one perspective, you were required to offer the opposing view in a point-counterpoint trade-off. The liberals were often plaintive and angry, while the conservatives were often smug and dismissive. After Reagan took office, this so-called fairness doctrine was done away with on the grounds that it was speculated to have a chilling effect on free speech. Sure didn't sound that way with all that freedom of invective. Anyway, from the 80s onward, you didn't have two competing opinions, but one man's. Usually an older white man's, conservative, curmudgeonly, and to this day, any mainstream news opining will typically have an appreciable neoliberal, pro-status quo, pro-capitalist slant. That's why it's so galling to hear incessantly about a liberal bias in the news, when the mainstream, even MSNBC, is plainly center-right. There's no such thing as liberal mainstream news. And if you don't believe me, go find the left-wing equivalent of Fox, Newsmax, or OAN, with actual Marxists, communists, and socialists advocating for the abolition of private property and the nationalization of the banks. The red state media loves the red scare, but trust that Joe Scarborough, Nicole Wallace, and Chuck Todd are not coming for your guns. Sleep safe tonight with the knowledge that Don Lemon, Rachel Maddow, and Chris Hayes will not be leading the motherfucking revolution, all right? Long tangent getting to the point. It wasn't until the Trump administration that the norms of something as simple and as static as a press conference had so deteriorated that both sides were screaming about the illegitimacy of one another. The partisan media might have ginned up a cycle over Obama wearing a tan suit, but now we had reporters openly mocking and expressing contempt toward administration officials who openly and unquestionably lied to their faces about things like the novel coronavirus that, as of this recording, has killed 266,000 Americans. That's 3 times the U.S. death toll in the entire Vietnam conflict. Never in anyone's lifetime has there been so public a breakdown of basic respect and dignity between a presidential administration and the media, which only accelerated the growing panic and discord among the general public. In short, we were scared, stupid, and pissed as hell, with no clear guidance from two essential pillars of our society. When you're living in a reality that unnervingly mirrors a 4-decade-old horror movie about the apocalypse, shit has gotten really real. If you look back at Night of the Living Dead, the whole movie is about generally well-meaning people arguing fiercely about what to do in a terrible situation for which nobody has any solid answers. We never find out why it happened or how it got started. There's a theory that fire holds back the undead, but it's barely used in the later films, and outright disputed in the Dawn remake. It seems like a good idea to make a run for the truck, but that turns out to be a barbecue for zombies. There's still a popular philosophical argument about whether the movie's villain, Harry Cooper, was right because the hero, Ben, ultimately falls back to Harry's plan. That's forgetting that Harry's cowardice and treachery contributed to their ongoing conflict and the situation spiraling out of control. But in the end, the posse had the right idea. If you have a gun, shoot them in the head. That's a sure way to kill them. If you don't, get yourself a club or a torch, beat them or burn them. They go up pretty easy. By Dawn of the Dead, the audience knows what needs to be done. Everybody has to wear a mask in public. If you can walk and talk, fuck your doctor's note, you're breathing fine. The mask does not trap in toxic levels of carbon dioxide because science, stupid. You either have anxiety or entitlement, but either way, quit queefing out of your pussy-ass face. Interact with as few people as possible. Isolate as much as possible, preferably in your home. Only eat with members of your inner circle. If you have symptoms like dry cough, fever, or loss of sense of taste or smell, you've probably been bit and you need to fuck off away from everyone else until we're sure whether you're fine or dead meat. In Dawn of the Dead, the rednecks get it. They may be making the best of a bad situation, but they're lined up to canvass the area and kill any undead that crosses their path. They're watching each other's backs and doing the hard work required. It's the city folks that are blowing it, arguing about the facts and denying the unpleasant reality. They're the ones strengthening the ranks of the undead and running off to bunkers while the rest of us are left to fend for ourselves. And so we come back to Dr. Foster, who ain't no Anthony Fauci. He's an antagonistic twerp that nobody in the room can stand. A prototype for Ghostbusters' Walter Peck, meaning an officious needle dick. But he's not wrong. Sidney Berman, for all his bluster, is at best Van Jones and at worst Geraldo Rivera. He's the sellout who traffics in, quote, moral bullshit. Dr. Foster represents Canada with 262 COVID deaths per million population. And if Quebec would listen to reason without emotion, it would be even lower. Foster is a nation of 37 million with only 10,000 COVID deaths. Berman is the USA with 800 deaths per million. Foster and Berman open the movie and their philosophies govern the movie. In a weird way, that makes Dr. Foster the hero of the story. As such, this seems like a fine time to do another actor spotlight, specifically for Dr. Foster. Unlike most of the performers on Spotlight so far, David Crawford is still with us, so I don't have a comprehensive obituary to copy from. He was born, and it happened in a place, presumably somewhere in North America, but not definitively. Forget what IMDb says, Crawford did not have a cinematic debut as David Robinson in a 1962 classic.
The IMDb is erroneous, and I should get in touch with them and correct it. They have me being in To Kill a Mockingbird with Gregory Peck, and I wasn't in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, I saw you. You were right there behind him in that one scene.
It's an imposter. No.
Supposedly he had a non-speaking part in an episode of Dragnet, but when I watched it, I didn't see him anywhere.
Yeah, I was an extra in a film before this, but this was the first speaking role.
Now, one of the things that we can't probably get away without talking about is your history in the horror genre as an actor. Very well known for your role in Dawn of the Dead, right?
Yes, Dawn of the Dead.
Because, wait, Night of the Living Dead came first.
Yes, that was a black and white one. Then Dawn was the one at Memorial Mall.
Yes, yes. So it makes sense that I suppose Dawn would follow Night of.
Yes.
George Romero,
of course,
was the director. And you were the sheriff, yes? Or the...
Oh, no.
Or the... I have not seen these movies. That may surprise you. Who did you play in Dawn of the Dead?
I'm aghast. I played Dr. James Foster.
Doctor, yes. I knew there was some sort of prefix to that.
He was a government scientist who was touring the country, going on TV, warning everybody about zombies, about the coming invasion of zombies, and look out, and this is what you have to do, dispose of the bodies this way. They didn't pay any attention.
To the facts?
They threw stuff at him, and they got what they deserved.
Well, good. Now, and what was the end story for your character then? I mean, was he elevated in the end to maybe, like, you know, Surgeon General of the United States for all of his insight into this? What became of him?
That story was not told. Mm. So it's up to the individual viewer to decide what happened to him. I think he would have lasted a long while because he had connections. He had a lot of knowledge about how to deal with zombies. But he would just come in the end, as everybody did.
Well, there's a story that does need to be told, I think. You know, so let's kind of float that out there. Maybe a sequel involving this man.
Yeah, well, George made sequels. He's made Night, Dawn, Day. He's up to late afternoon tea time of the Living Dead now. but he hasn't used Dr. Foster anymore. Maybe the next one.
I think there's some opportunity there.
Well, I auditioned. I saw an audition notice on a bulletin board somewhere, probably at Carnegie Mellon, and went down and read for George, and he cast me. It was very easygoing. George didn't ask a lot of questions. He knew what he wanted and knew how to get it. And he knew what kinds of actors he wanted for the parts, and so it was a pretty quick decision for him, I think.
Well, you bring up an interesting question, and that is, what kind of director is George Romero?
Laid back. He's this big bear of a guy. He knows how to tell people what he wants, and they do it, and he watches them do it. And it's probably the least tension on a set that I've ever seen. It's a kind of calm confidence that things are going to go well, that he's planned it out the way he wants it, and he's communicated what he wants, and it'll happen.
So I take it there's not a lot of retakes?
No, we did very few. Well, David Early and I, who had the scene that opens Dawn of the Dead, we do all the exposition, all the explaining what zombies are all about. We had worked on stage together. And so we got together at my apartment above this pizza shop, and we were students at the time.
Okay.
and rehearsed quite a bit, and so we came to shoot day pretty much having it nailed. George watched us, and he said, yeah, that's fine. You go ahead with what you got there. And so George, his main job was to get the crowd to the right place. And, you know the people in the studio, the crew of the new show, were harassing me and giving me bunny ears and all of that. And George got that together.
Well, I gave Dawn of the Dead too little respect in the beginning. It was, for me, it was only half a day's work. David Early and I did our scene in the newsroom in about half a day. I don't think I even got lunch.
I never thought when we made Dawn of the Dead that it would become so deeply ingrained in the pop culture and so madly admired by people. Horror fans are really into it. And it has had a life way beyond anything I thought would happen. At the time, we thought, well, it's only George. You know, he makes those commercials and stuff.
Uh-huh. I had known him as a maker of documentaries and commercials, and he was known as a brilliant editor, the best editor anywhere. But we didn't think he could actually direct a movie. We knew about Night of the Living Dead, but, you know, could have been a fluke. So I didn't have any respect for this movie in the beginning.
In fact, it wasn't my best job that week. That week, my best job was being Winker, who was the mascot of the Winkies hamburger chain, a local franchise. And I would go around to, dressed in 30 pounds of orange fake fur, looking like a Muppet. And I'd go to the stores and I'd say, "Hey, kids, eat your hamburgers. They're good for you."
Huh? Winkies makes you happy to be hungry in lots of ways. There's fish, chicken, hamburgers. What's your favorite?
Chicken!
Oh, my noses!
I made a couple hundred bucks that week off of that job.
What a range this man has, ladies and gentlemen.
I remember Don was paying $50.
Wow.
David Early, who was in the scene with me, says it was 100, but I don't believe him. In fact, if he got 100, I have to speak to George.
Yeah, there's some unfinished business there, it sounds like.
Welcome to Winkorama. Here's tonight's question. Winkies makes you happy to be hungry lots of ways. Can you name 10 of them? Ready? Go!
Picnic and chicken, great ones, cheeseburgers, fish and chips, big winks, milkshakes, french fries, great roast beef, turnovers, breakfasts, fish sandwiches.
You win, Ernie.
Hey, I didn't hear the question. What was the question?
Winkies makes you happy to be hungry.
Winkies Hamburgers was a chain of fast food restaurants launched out of the Jiffy Steak Company in 1962. Winkies was founded by brothers Harold and Bernard Ehrenstein. After they noticed that they were getting unusually high orders from one of the new McDonald's franchises out in Virginia, they figured anything McDonald's could do, they could do as well, especially with the advantage of supplying their own meat. Building a reputation off their 15-cent burgers, within 3 years, there were 14 locations in and around Pittsburgh. Winkies peaked in 1977, not long before the release of Dawn of the Dead, with 42 stores franchises after expanding into West Virginia and Ohio. When the steel industry imploded due to high foreign competition and overhead, plus the Rust Belt depression from a fading domestic industrial base, the regional economy tanked. Winkies went under rapidly in the early 80s, and the company was bankrupt by 1982.
Hey, Ernie, got a pen?
Sure, here's my big banana.
Thanks! Now can I borrow your pen?
You dope, that was my pen. I got it free when I bought a big wink and a big drink at Winkies.
I thought it tasted funny.
Well, we can go to Winkies and get a big wink and a big drink and get another big banana free.
Yeah, let's go to Winkies, please. I'm so hungry I could eat your hat. But I think I'd rather have a big wink. Let's go.
So I had no respect until around the year 2000, maybe before that, David Early called me and said he had been invited to a horror convention in Cleveland and had made a lot of money signing autographs. I was shocked. I had no idea you could make money signing autographs. But here I am, and I am grateful to George and to David Early, and to you.
As a result of that role, do you get invited to, like, the comic conventions and the horror conventions and things?
Oh, yeah, I do. Went to two last year, one in Germany, one in England, and I had a great time. It's really a privilege, a wonderful privilege to go to those things.
So, David, what do you do at a horror convention?
Oh, well, if you've been in the horror movies and you have fans, you just sit at a table and sign autographs. People bring posters to be signed, and you always have some pictures of your part in the movies. It's a kind of micro-fame. I enjoy it immensely. It's nice to be famous, if only in a small scale, at particular times. But the fans are very sweet. They really appreciate George's work particularly. He's the icon. He's the god. And they enjoy talking with the rest of us who were involved in all that.
What is the strangest experience that you've had as a result of that film? Like, out at the horror conventions, you know, have you had any bizarre encounters with fans, anything?
Not really bizarre. Horror fans are amazingly normal. They have a lot of tattoos. They're great people. I mean, really friendly and warm. And I have never gotten into any kind of weird... in Germany, this Belgium guy walks up to me after the convention. We're downstairs having something to eat. He walks up to me and he's got a wad of euros in his hand. And he says, "Come on up to my room."
Is that where the story ends?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know, Belgians are very friendly, I hear, you know?
Yes.
All right, well, that's interesting.
Apparently desperate as well.
Oh.
You know, it's amazing. You would think that a convention with a horror theme would have horrible things happening, but it really is always a pleasant experience. It's very sweet. And the people who are zombie fans are very sweet people. The ones at Monroeville are very good because the fans there are extremely interested and always very pleasant. Everybody is who is associated with the horror movies. I guess the worst was one that it was brand new and it was in a small town. It had not been publicized and nobody came. Nobody knew it was there. So it was a long day of sitting by myself.
Had you worked with George Romero since Dawn of the Dead?
I have not. No. He doesn't work here in Pittsburgh anymore. He works in Toronto. There has not been an opportunity. And I went off in another direction, so we weren't in touch for decades.
So what have you been up to since then?
Well, there was a stretch of being a film director, writer, editor. I did a lot of that for years, but always kept one foot on the stage. I've worked at most of the theaters around town, public and city and picked and so on, and taught a while at CLO Academy, taught acting. Theater has been my life in one way or another ever since.
Despite being featured in pretty much every advertisement for Dawn of the Dead, Crawford's next role didn't come until a 1984 TV movie.
Did a couple of movies for PBS. A Boy Who Loved Trolls. I played the boy's father.
Hey, I'm home.
Hi, honey. How was your trip?
Not the usual. Paul, that TV is awfully loud.
I missed you.
I missed you, too. Tell you what, why don't we all go out to dinner tonight?
Oh, I'd love to, but Paul has homework.
Yeah, well, Paul does his homework. We'll go out to dinner.
Paul, there's leftover casserole for you down in the refrigerator. So if you get hungry later, you can heat it up in the microwave.
Okay.
Okay, we're not going to be very late, so you be sure and finish your homework while we're gone.
Mom, can we read this together like we used to?
Oh, Paul, aren't you getting a little big for this?
We're going to be late if we don't hurry.
I have to go, sweetheart. Now, you stop being silly and finish your homework. Paul.
Such things as trolls anywhere on earth.
Hey, a big guy like you doesn't believe in trolls.
No matter what his father said, Paul hoped the trolls did exist because he thought that meeting a troll would be so exciting. And so Paul decided it was time to find out once and for all about the realness of trolls.
The Boy Who Loved Trolls was produced for PBS's Wonderworks. partially out of WQED Pittsburgh, and was a remake of a black and white film called Afote, itself based on a stage play. Matt Dill, Sam Waterston, and Susan Anton are the stars of the picture, but notable supporting players included a young William H. Macy, ALF patriarch Max Wright, and of greatest interest to our show, James Karen from The Return of the Living Dead.
Give this boy a reward, anything he wants, anything in the world. I was, of course, considering the exact same move, but, well, I think the decent impulse is to encourage young people.
And Tom Savini as, what else, a motorcyclist.
Excuse me. Do you know where I can find a troll?
Yeah, I don't know, kid. Did you look under a bridge? I mean, that's where I always go when I'm looking for a troll.
Maybe he was playing Blades before the Undead Rising. The story revolves around a boy that has yet to outgrow his interest in fantasy. He falls asleep while reading a book on trolls, and dreams of an adventure involving modern high-tech bad actors pursuing troll gold or some such, while government spooks are also in pursuit. The kid randomly receives a call from a payphone.
Paul, this is your father. I want you home right now. You have homework, remember?
The program was released on VHS by BWE Video, but you can catch it in a series of YouTube uploads.
Paul, we're home.
Hey, big guy. We brought dessert.
Crawford's next role would actually reach the silver screen again.
I had the good fortune to work with Diane Lane in Lady Beware, which was a stalker film. I played her father.
Hello?
Oh, I know. I know all about you.
Stop it.
It's her job to design store windows that people will notice. But now, someone is noticing her. Someone dangerous.
Somebody followed you home.
Who is this?
Somebody who's on the same track as you.
Hello?
You know, I know exactly what you're doing in those windows.
You better stop calling me!
It's just some poor slob who hasn't got anything better to do.
This guy is different.
You know, you have got great fantasies. But you can't leave them in the window forever.
Fantasies have turned into nightmares.
I think I knew you'd answer sooner or later, huh?
I think it's time we meet.
And her nightmares are about to become reality. Diane Lane. Lady Beware. When fantasy leads to terror.
The 1987 thriller tackled the subject of stalking before that term was in common use, and it should come as no surprise it was filmed in and around Pittsburgh. Katya Yarno is a window dresser who attracts new attention to stodgy old Horn's department store through her sexually charged street displays. The hugely successful comedy Mannequin, starring Kim Cattrall and Andrew McCarthy, had been released that Valentine's Day. And while a six-month turnaround suggests the premise was less stolen and more something in the air, Lady Beware did not replicate its success. It made less than $170,000 on a $3 million budget. I would argue that this was through no fault of star Diane Lane, who at about 21 years old, could definitely inspire unwanted attention even without the kinky mannequin dioramas. Perhaps the only thing Lady Beware had in common with the troll movie was that David Crawford plays the lead character's unnamed father.
Hello.
Daddy?
Katya? Hey, what's up, Buttercup?
Nothing, I'm just calling to see how everything is.
Oh, your mother has a cold. Nothing serious, but you know how she is.
She's got Father Theodore lighting candles for every hour.
Daddy, has anybody unusual asked about me?
No, not that I can think of. By the way, did you get my letter?
What letter?
I mailed it Wednesday. You ought to have it by now. Oh, well, it's the mails. You know how that is. Katya, something wrong, Buttercup? Do you still love me?
I love you, Daddy. Tell Mama she's in my prayers, okay?
Crawford's next role, according to the previously established as unreliable IMDb, came in the 1998 British comedy What Rats Won't Do, starring Natasha McElhone and James Frayne, also featuring Peter Capaldi, Parker Posey, and Charles Dance. I personally couldn't find Crawford, but it's a pleasant rom-com if you wish to have your own look. Likewise, Crawford is credited with a tiny role in the British film The Tichborne Claimant, but I strongly suspect that there's an English David Crawford that's having his extra work misattributed.
But mostly I work on stage. I like it.
So, given the choice between film and stage, you'd prefer to do stage?
Given a choice between making a fortune in the movies and having a great time on stage, I'll take stage, yeah.
I hear that. So, if you really want him for a role, and you're willing to pay him $500,000 for a day's work, he'll turn it down to go do a week. No, I don't think so.
I take that back.
Okay, good.
I'm free in August and September. Well, I'm not free, but I'm cheap.
Yeah, never free. Inexpensive, maybe. Never cheap.
Okay.
Inexpensive, because, you know, you get quality, you get what you pay for, and this man is a quality actor.
Crawford has been a prolific stage actor as well as a playwright, with roles in Ray Warner's Elder Hostages, Samuel Hazo's Tell It to the Marines, August Wilson's Jim of the Sea, Dulce, The Speckled Band, Much Ado About Nothing, Oliver, My Fair Lady, Romeo and Juliet.
You sing?
More or less. I sing well enough to be the older character actor, not well enough to be the leading man.
Ah, okay.
3 Days in the Country, The Rivals, White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, Henry IV, The Glass Menagerie, and as Scrooge in A Christmas Carol.
Well, now, as far as personality goes, everybody's playing this game on Facebook now, where it's just define yourself with three fictional characters. Uh-huh. And I follow you on Facebook, and I saw yours, which I thought was very interesting. Your three fictional characters were all different depictions of Ebenezer Scrooge.
Uh-huh.
Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah.
So now, is that Scrooge before the three ghosts visit him, or are you more Scrooge after the three ghosts visit him?
Oh, that's before the three ghosts.
Yeah.
But the punchline was Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah.
So it was just a joke.
Well, Scrooge McDuck, I think, actually played Ebenezer Scrooge in the Disney Scrooge. So I took that as also a third Ebenezer Scrooge.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So do you see yourself as a crotchety curmudgeon that doesn't like Christmas? Is that what you're trying to tell us?
Well, no, that's not really me. I don't celebrate Christmas because for many years being a starving actor, I couldn't afford it. So I never got into the habit. But I'm not really all that curmudgeonly, am I?
Well, I...
Tell me, am I?
For Crawford's sake, I hope he was an extra in Wicked Pictures' Sidney Steele vehicle Euphoria, but I kind of doubt it. I do remember that box cover from my days working at the sex shop, but I don't believe that I ever rented it myself. On the other hand, I'm absolutely certain that Crawford is in the 2008 no-budget zombie flick Sabbath, because he's right there in the trailer.
Recently, I did a horror movie called Sabbath, produced here in Ohio. And some other independent films.
I'm not sure which offends me more, the title or the production values.
It has begun. You know what to do.
Quiet. Look away. Someone as it draws you. It was a blackout at first, terrorism, whatever. But then I saw Mrs. Evans. She passed away 2 days ago, but there she was walking, shuffling toward the church. He will come again to judge the living and the dead. Tell me, have you ever been chased?
you have any weapons.
Point that motherfucker, shoot him right between the eyes.
You have been judged. You are the last.
Yeah, it's the production values. I'm just going to read the summary off the IMDb page. When the last soul enters heaven and the first sinner is shut out of hell, life as we know it will cease to exist. Geller, played by Ashley Gallo, runs for her life from the bloodthirsty zombies that seem to have overrun her small town. For help during end times, she turns to Mac, a criminal, two shady brothers, and a faithless reverend, played by David Crawford. Geller and her new friends are on the run from roving hordes of zombies, shadow demons, and the Grim Reaper.
How do you think they compare to, you know, some of the zombie genre things that are out now, like on TV? All cheap imitations.
Yes.
Right?
In fact, there's a story out that they asked George to direct an episode of The Walking Dead, and he said, not that trash.
Wow. Some
words to that effect.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think he was that crass. Now, the big thing is, and this is a controversy among zombie fans, should they walk? Mm-hmm. Or should they run? You know, the modern ones run. I think in The Walking Dead they run. The Running Dead, it should be.
Huh.
I think they should walk. I think the old-fashioned way is best. I think the old-fashioned special effects are best.
Yeah.
You know, when you squirt red juice on somebody for blood. I think that works better than computerized effects. It looks more real, paradoxically. And I think lumbering zombies are better because that forces the author and the director to make the horror come from something other than being chased.
Yeah.
And also, something we learn in acting school is slowness shows power. Mm. If you're playing like
status,
a, yeah, a king, you move deliberately and slowly. If you get fast, it's, you know, it's like flibbertigibbet. It's not the same thing.
I think Crawford is one of several actors in Dawn of the Dead that have excellent speaking voices. So I'm not surprised he was asked to narrate an animated short in 2010. Animals, spelled with a capital Z, is described by director Moshe Mahler on his website. Animals follows the development of a young guinea pig named Ned. The youthful guinea pig enjoys playing, eating, and dancing. As Ned grows, so does his love for dancing. Ned quickly ventures into an outside world inhabited by animal-human hybrids, some of which are more animal than human. The computer animated and mo-capped short can be seen in full on Vimeo.
Witness a miracle of nature. The birth of the modern guinea pig. He's a cute little fellow. His name is Ned. Life for a baby guinea pig is simple. He likes to eat. He likes to play. But he also likes to dance. Keep at it. It is not long before the adolescent guinea pig begins to develop his shoes, a fine pair of sneakers. He is also becoming more agile, much more agile. Finally, he has developed into a beautifully matured specimen, ready for the outside world. For the piggy. Let's have a look around. Over there is the sheep district. Kind of self-involved for a herded species. This creature looks innocent enough, but it is mating season for the pig, and that car is illegally parked. Oh, and look at the cute puppy over there.
I am no puppy. I am a fully grown male dog. Back in your face. Back.
With no time to settle into his new environment, Ned must encounter his first predator. Uh-oh, this guy looks like a real asshole. Yes, yes, do what you do best. Dance. He soon realizes these shoes were not made for dancing. Run! Run, young guinea pig! Run!
Content with his meal, the predator ceases his pursuit. No, these shoes are not made for running. Tired and out of breath, still he must continue his journey. That's it, Ned. Keep dancing.
David Crawford's final release to date is 2014's Wormwood's End, the sequel to writer-director William Victor Schotten's 2005 direct-to-video micro-budget zombie flick Dead Life. I'll just do a mashup of both films' synopses from IMDb. A deadly virus called necrotizing fasciitis, M, is running rampant through Midwest America, killing the living and reviving the dead. Life changes quickly for Max and his friends as survival becomes a struggle. The group is consumed one by one as Max prepares for his final face-off with the Walking Dead. 4 months after the apocalypse was all it took to turn people into monsters and monsters into devils. Three survivors seek refuge from the Wormwood Militia, only to find Camp Wormwood may offer protection from the Walking Dead, but holds many dangers of its own. But once the living dead begin to change into unstoppable necro-devils, the future begins to look hopeless. It's good guys versus bad guys versus worse guys in this post-apocalyptic landscape. Who will come out on top and what will be left?
The name of the star is Wormwood, and a third of the waters turned bitter. Many people died from the waters that had become bitter.
The door of Wormwood opens.
We welcome you.
I don't like it here. I don't get a good vibe.
Take your chances with the zombies. This is no place for a woman. What are you talking about?
No, they'll look at this as treason. They'll do this.
There's things happening here you have no idea. Bad things.
The dead were bad. These are worse.
Living in the dead zone of zombie pictures, Crawford finally returns home to Romero grounds with the as-yet-unreleased Night of the Living Dead Genesis, which began filming in 2013. There was a teaser trailer released in 2016 featuring original Barbara actress Judith O'Day reprising her role in the prequel, sidequel, sequel. Did anybody ever come up with a proper term for one of those? May I suggest periquel? The producers tried to crowdsource $35,000 in finishing funds through Indiegogo and only received $565 in pledges from seven backers. So don't hold your breath on this one.
I think we as human beings are fascinated by horror because it helps us to feel our fears and to deal with them. Zombies, I think, are in the air now because apocalypse is in the air. There are so many threats to the survival of the human race, the well-being of the planet. We feel the fear because we read about it, from global warming, the jihads in the Middle East, to nuclear proliferation, to all kinds of new threats with robots, medical research, and so on. We know about these threats, and we need to deal with them. And watching zombies happen, and watching people deal with them, I think helps us to face our own fears a little more.
George Romero certainly did the zombie genre justice, as you now are doing Edgar Allan Poe, justice.
Oh.
Well, I have my two solo shows. In one, I portray Edgar Allan Poe, and the other one, H.P. Lovecraft, who's also a horror writer. And I'm working on a third one. And I do perform those sometimes. I did the Poe show a couple of weeks ago in Oakmont, Pennsylvania, at the Oaks Theater. They put my name up on the marquee, and it was a great experience. And I'll do those shows again.
Crawford also performed in two solo shows, Lovecraft's Monsters, and most notably as Edgar Allan Poe in Poe's Last Night, performed at both the Playwrights Theatre and in Scotland at the Robert Burns Club of Irvine.
David Crawford, creator and star of Poe's Last Night, currently at the Pittsburgh Playwrights Theater in downtown Pittsburgh through the 19th of January. How did this show come about?
Well, it all started at a horror convention in Chicago about 3 years ago. I had a fairly prominent role in Romero's Dawn of the Dead, so I get invited to horror conventions to meet the fans. And the guy sitting next to me was selling Edgar Allan Poe t-shirts, and they were gone like hotcakes, one after another after another. And I thought, well, maybe people would be interested in a show about Poe if there is that much popularity. And it would give me another reason to go back to the horror conventions to perform the show. Memorizing The Raven and some of the stories, and doing the research as well, reading biographies, reading his work. I took a lot of dramatic license. I put as much of the facts in as possible. He did spend his last nights outside a hospital on the streets of Baltimore and in taverns, and was discovered there by someone who knew him. He then spent 4 days in the hospital before he died. So I just kind of collapsed that into one night on the streets. It does involve a lot of his work and a reflection of his life on several themes. His uniqueness and his feeling of being alone, his love for his wife and other women, his mourning for his mother who died when he was only 3 years old, and the search for a substitute, and his enemies in the literary world, which was vicious and mean and full of aggression and hostility and recrimination. What's unique about his style? The greatness of Poe is not in his style. He was okay as a stylist, but talk to an English professor and he may be dismissive. You know, there are better writers in the world. What was great about Poe was his imagination and his invention. He invented the detective story. He invented the science fiction story, wrote the first of those. He brought the Gothic tradition from Germany over here to the United States and invented our horror story. I selected the things that reflected his life. For example, the poem Alone, which declares his individuality. The poem, one of the poems, or two of them, but this one, To Helen, was written to the woman he chose as his adopted mother after his own mother died. Annabel Lee was written to his wife. The Pit and the Pendulum reflects his feeling of being oppressed and mistreated by his colleagues in the literary world. Most interesting to me was the Cask of Amontillado. It's amazing the parallels between his foster father, with whom he did not get along at all, and the character in the cask who is walled up in the crypt. They were both wealthy, fortunate men, pillars of the community, connoisseurs of wine, masons, and they had, the foster father's case, they had mistreated and then insulted Poe, and in the character's case in the cask, had mistreated and insulted the principal narrator. So I found those parallels fascinating. And then I used the Raven at the end as a kind of closure, as a kind of him going off to his fate. We actually have sound cues and light cues and a set. It just amazes me. Oh, well, we have the pendulum creaking back and forth. We have doors creaking open and shut. And we actually have the Raven at one point flying into the room. Oh, street sounds. This is on the streets. So we have carriages and drunks laughing and all sorts of things like that.
How many people are doing a Poe one-man show that you know of?
There are a few, and I don't have a catalog of them. John Astin, who's a well-known actor, did one for years, but I think he's retired from it now. He's rather elderly. And there's a man in Baltimore who does one there. There's somebody in Los Angeles who tours one around, and there may be others as well. It's a kind of cottage industry, yeah, for actors who are between engagements, between triumphs.
Planet Earth, home to over 6 billion people. Today, our very existence is threatened by epidemics, climate change, and dwindling resources. But those are the least of our problems. Welcome to Zombieland.
My mother always told me, someday you'll be good at something. I mean, I don't think she could have guessed that something would be zombie killing.
What do you think? Zombie kill of the week?
Close, but no cigar. Zombie kill of the week went to Miss Cynthia Knickerbocker.
Gotta enjoy the little things.
these fellas really let themselves go.
Zombieland.
You guys want some Purell?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
I saw Zombieland theatrically in October of 2009 with one of my two best friends and his longtime girlfriend. Shaun of the Dead had already launched the modern zombie comedy 5 years earlier, but that was an imported cult hit with some grisly elements not for the faint-hearted. It was Zombieland that fully mainstreamed the zombie. Zombieland was technically R-rated, but come on, man. Gwen Stacy, Haymitch, Mark Zuckerberg, and Little Miss Sunshine are still in this thing. There's a lot of blood and satisfying gore, but that's offset by purely PG-13 tone and stakes. This is the one that launched with all the amusing numbered rules to surviving the zombie apocalypse and helped introduce audiences to Jesse Eisenberg and Emma Stone, one of my favorite current actresses. Everybody loves Woody Harrelson, and it was novel to have a little kid like Abigail Breslin as an active participant instead of just bait. The cast has great chemistry, and watching their burgeoning relationships develop keeps things fresh throughout the flick. There's the infamous cameo, a host of gooey kills, with top-notch effects and stunts thanks to a healthy budget. I still cringe during Amber Heard's zombie turn, not because I'm a Johnny Depp stan, but because there's effective tension in some of the film sequences. I mean, who hasn't struggled to unpucker while attempting to drop deuce in a sinister-looking stall, even without the undead literally chomping at your heels? It's a great-looking movie that continues to amuse over a decade later. And speaking of that passage of time...
Welcome to Zombieland. Life is about more than just survival. We were a family. Dysfunctional, sure, but what family isn't?
Merry Christmas! What would you like, little girl?
I'd really like for you to stop calling me little girl.
But do you know what I would like?
I don't give a shit what you mean.
It felt so good to be on the move again.
Whoa! Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Hi, I'm Columbus.
Madison.
This is Tallahassee.
Hey, Paul Blart. Is this your dad? Oh, whoopsie, I forgot the seatbelt rule.
Oh, so she knows the rules?
I told her just a few of them.
73, and are there more?
You're cute. I like it.
Rules are for pussies, nothing personal.
How could that not be personal? That's like my whole thing.
Yeah, you're right, it's personal.
New kind of zombies, stronger, faster, better adapted to the hunt.
They're much more afraid of us than we are of them.
You'll be the first to die, but I like your enthusiasm.
You might die.
Yeah, thank you for your sacrifice.
From the director of Venom.
Need a ride?
Oh, yeah.
And writers of Deadpool.
Casablanca.
Oh, God.
Well, I think I would have made a damn fine president.
I think those cigars were left over from the Clinton administration. My sister is gone. She picked up a boy. He's from Berkeley.
Berkeley!
You don't have weed, do you?
Do I look like the type of person that would have weed?
I'm sorry.
Boom!
Yeah?
I have nothing against
hippies. I just want to beat the shit out of them.
We're gonna go get her. We ride it, dawn.
Start talking.
You first.
Well, my name's Tallahassee.
Oh, my apologies, little Elvis.
Okay, is it me, or does he kind of remind you of...
I don't like you. At all.
I think you double parked. Or more perpendicular parked. Hope we don't get a ticket.
What is going on here?
What?
Hello, everyone.
Am I hallucinating?
We got one of those extra long waits between installments with a 2019 sequel. The subtitle Double Tap indicates that this will be more of a retread than a reinvention, and that's honest advertising. Anybody who watched the failed unaired Zombieland TV pilot should be aware that part of the reason for the movie's success was that they stuffed a season's worth of gags into it. Everything that the filmmakers had in them with regard to this material was already in the first flick, and a decade has only made what little they had left stale as a Twinkie. There's a few new gags, like mirror universe versions of the male leads played by Luke Wilson and Thomas Middlestitch. Goes back to at least Seinfeld and was a running bit on How I Met Your Mother. It's amusing here, but I couldn't help but be distracted by their having gotten the wrong Wilson brother for faux Tallahassee. Zombieland was always very sitcom-y, but we're in the late series Married with Children territory here. It's all No Ma'am, Monster Trucks, and George Thorogood Bad to the Bone riffs. Time is a big problem here, because we all go in with the assumption that a decade has passed. It's unbelievable that a Valley Girl could have survived in a mall freezer for that length of time, much less with a gym bod and perfect makeup. I guess you could argue that half that time has passed and Abigail Breslin's character is still a teenager. And maybe they did, but not hard enough that I can remember any such attempt. Zoe Deutsch's hyperactive idiocy was, for me, a pleasant Kelly Bundy diversion. But I understand where other people might want to gouge out their own eardrums when she speaks. Conceits like an untouched, weapons-free stoner encampment are tough to swallow. The super zombie variants will redline the irritation of anyone already not on board with fast zombies. Actually, a problem for me was that they set up the threat of the super zombies in one scene, then reinforce it in the doppelganger sequence, which has the strongest tension and stunt work. Then the conclusion is your typical zombie stampede, seemingly forgetting the escalation the filmmakers had taken pains to illustrate. I usually welcome Rosario Dawson and Elvis references, but they don't have any material to work with. It's just using Rosario Dawson and Graceland as an audience applause signal. The conflicts are gratingly manufactured, especially when Wichita and Little Rock are expected to settle for Tallahassee and Columbus as the end-all be-all of their relationship goals. Abigail Breslin's Little Rock is mostly written out in the first act. Her reprises are glorified cameos, and the plot is meandering. There are worse ways to kill an hour and a half, but I wouldn't recommend a double feature if you don't want to feel like you just watched the same movie twice. The arc of the first picture is Nebish and Redneck form unlikely bond for mutual survival. Nebish slowly wins over tough but emotionally skittish girl by being the best of few prospects, and a family unit is formed with her young charge. Then all the characters are basically in the same place a decade on. Little Rock bolts because she wants a boy instead of an amusement park. Wichita follows her lead to avoid potential vulnerability. Tallahassee retreats into toxic masculinity. Columbus bumblefucks around until he's finally made to go after the girls to reunite the family. Otherwise, to nut up or shut up. There's some exhausting Ross and Rachel bullshit that reminds you the odds are very much against the central romance. In fact, I think the male leads already had their arc in the first film, and the smart play would have been to reverse the focus to the female leads. Little Rock never had an arc, and career-wise, Abigail Breslin has got to be the hungriest actor working on this thing. Rather than being about the bros settling into domesticity, maybe show that family life was never Wichita's endgame. It could have been 500 days of zombie summer, and Zoe Deutsch's Madison might have been an actual love interest instead of a walking torture porn of humorous misogynistic stereotyping. The movie seems to have done well enough, earning twice its budget theatrically, but the original quadrupled its budget at the box office. It seems like folks still want to spend time with these characters, but maybe not the exact same time as the first, because Double Tap got that Ghostbusters 2 stink all over it.
Randy, get the new list of rescue stations. Charlie's receiving on the emergency.
We have an updated list of rescue stations that include the 20th Century Geek Podcast, Adriano, Ann Labs, who added Thank You, Baby Skeletor, Chris Leiden, Chris Thompson, CJ, who added Another Good Episode, Looking Forward to More Than Twice a Year, LOL, Dirk Ashton, who added Thanks RSP, Arrow Mero Mero, Green Lantern HG, Feel the Fear, Then Overcome It, I Was Joe Crawford, Just in Time with the J&T Baggers, Carl Disley, Keith G. Baker, King Dinosaur, Mike at Send Alias to Me, Mix Jeffrey Brown, Randy Caldwell, Reverend Odell Abner Dracula, Richard G, Richard Van Ingram, Schlochtopus, Shanna Banana, Talk Nerdy to Me, Tim Mason, and Xenozoic Xenophiles.